Hello, it's Richard McLean Smith here with a quick update before we dive into today's episode. Unexplained is very excited to be a part of Crime Wave at Sea this November, joining forces with some of the eeriest voices in the world of true crime and the paranormal. 4 nights in the Caribbean with amazing podcasts like Last Podcast on the Left, Scared to Death, and many more. Live shows, meet and greets, creepy stories under the stars, and you can be there too. But don't wait. Rooms are nearly sold out. Head to crimewaveatsea.com/unexplained to grab your fan code and lock in your cabin. We'd love to see you on board. It was late one evening in November 1953, and a storm was brewing in the skies over northern Michigan, USA. Brutal winds whistled across the chilly surfaces of the Great Lakes. But inside the Kinross Air Force Base, just a few miles from the Canadian border, all was quiet. With the long Thanksgiving weekend just a couple of days away, the base was emptier than usual, with some officers already on leave for the week. The sound of the radar ping caught everybody off guard. In the ground control suite, Second Lieutenant Douglas Stewart leaned forward in his chair, squinting hard at the unexpected intruder, an unidentified object in US airspace about 160 miles to the northwest of the base. It was heading east, but right then, Douglas was more concerned about its origin than its destination. It seemed to be coming from a restricted airspace over the Sioux Locks. Consisting of 2 canals and 4 parallel locks, the Sioux Locks are a vital part of America's global trade infrastructure. They allow cargo ships to travel from the Great Lakes region all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. Any threat in their vicinity was taken extremely seriously. The ground control staff double-checked their records, but they already knew what they would find. No unscheduled aircraft had permission to fly in this area, nor had any new requests come in. Whatever this object in the sky was, it was not playing by the rules. Since 1947 and the events in Roswell, New Mexico, speculation and conspiracy theories about UFOs had gripped the United States. But the people employed at Kinross Air Force Base were not prone to such fantasizing. Their job was to approach every situation from a rational and scientific perspective. This often meant applying the principle of Occam's razor. All else being equal, the simplest explanation is likely to be the correct one. And so it was with that in mind that Douglas Stewart and his colleagues came up with a working theory for what was going on. The base was less than 30 miles from the northern border, and there was a Canadian Air Force base not far away on the other side. Clearly, the object was a Royal Canadian Air Force transport plane that had clumsily diverged from its route. Its intended flight path was probably within Canada, from the base near Winnipeg to another in Ontario. But thanks to the high winds and poor visibility, it had veered off course, just enough to veer into US airspace. In other words, this was all probably a false alarm. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard McLean Smith. Radar can tell you a lot about an aircraft, its position in the sky, its speed of travel, and its vicinity to other aircraft, but it can't provide much of a visual, and it definitely can't differentiate friend from foe. For that, back in the 1950s, only human eyes will do. Many Air Force bases have 1 or 2 Alert 5 aircraft, that is, fighter jets that are on standby, ready to be airborne within 5 minutes if they're needed. On that night of November 23rd, 1953, Kinross had 2. The unidentified object was first spotted at 6:17 p.m, and by 6:20 p.m, a fighter jet was ready to take off. Despite the likelihood that the situation was a false alarm, it was still a daunting mission. Conditions were terrible, with scattered snowstorms and a thick layer of cloud impacting visibility. The US Air Force needed a steady hand, somebody who could fly using only their instruments and keep a calm head no matter what this thing turned out to be. 27-year-old First Lieutenant Felix Moncler Jr. was the man for the job. Although still relatively early in his career, Moncler was an experienced pilot who was no stranger to conflict. He'd served in the military during World War II, then re-enlisted in the Air Force when the American-Korean War began in 1950. He'd clocked more than 800 flying hours. At 6:22, Moncler climbed into the cockpit of an F-89C fighter jet. Behind him was his navigator, Second Lieutenant Robert Wilson, who was in charge of radar observation while Moncler piloted the jet. Designed by famed aircraft industrialist Jack Northrop, the F-89C was one of the best and fastest aircrafts the Air Force had at its disposal. Its nickname, the Scorpion, referred to its distinctive lifted tail, but also to its deadly capabilities. It was specifically designed to chase and intercept hostile enemy aircraft. For the purposes of this mission, the Scorpion was given the equally dramatic callsign, Avenger Red. Moncler and Wilson ran through their usual pre-flight checks, making sure that the Scorpion systems were all functioning correctly. And then, First Lieutenant Moncler taxied the plane over to its assigned runway at the base, as thick flakes of snow drifted down onto the cockpit window. Moncler and Wilson rattled about inside the cockpit as the jet eased upwards through a thick blanket of low-hanging cloud. Moments later, and they'd burst through and leveled off under the soft blue light of a bright, waning gibbous. Beneath them was only cloud, while above twinkled all the stars of the known universe. Moncler flicked on the radio and reported his position back to base, but every time he tried, the signal kept cutting out due to the tumultuous weather below. Behind him, Second Lieutenant Wilson was also struggling to track their position on radar. He stared at the green blip of the unidentified object on the screen with frustration. Just as he seemed to have its trajectory locked in, the mysterious aircraft suddenly changed direction. It was as though it knew it was being chased. But whatever it was no match for the Scorpion. After a few more minutes of flying, Moncler's radio settled down, and with Wilson finally getting a handle on the object's location, he deftly began to direct Moncler to the necessary position. With Avenger Red zipping through the sky at 500 miles per hour, 20 minutes later, they'd caught up with it. It was 6:50 p.m. when they began closing in. At Wilson's instruction, Moncler angled the nose of the Scorpion downwards toward the heavy cloud below and prepared to intercept the unidentified object at around 7,000 feet. Back at ground control, at 6:52 p.m., Second Lieutenant Douglas Stewart radioed Moncler to confirm they were 10 miles out from their target, which was roughly towards 11 o'clock from their position. A burst of static came back, followed by Moncler's voice. "Copy that," he said. A moment later, Stewart told Moncler to be aware that the target would be coming up on his left side, but moving across to his right. If he didn't see it on the first try, they would redirect him to attempt a second pass. But this time, they heard nothing back from the cockpit. Second Lieutenant Douglas Stewart wasn't too concerned about Moncler's lack of response. The reception had been a problem all night, and it was most likely that Moncler simply hadn't received his last message. And even if they had, they were at a critical moment in their flight, probably absorbed in other tasks. So Stewart and his colleagues turned their attention to the radar screens and watched in silence as the two green blips moved closer and closer to each other. It was 6:55 p.m. when the Scorpion's radar icon converged with the unidentified object. For that brief moment, they became a single blip, flashing together in unison on the screen. Typically, this indicates that one aircraft has pulled in directly alongside the other, and the two are flying in formation. This is standard procedure for an Air Force intercept. Nonetheless, Stewart and the rest of the team held their breath as they continued to stare at the merged dots, waiting for them to separate. It was strange. It seemed to be taking longer than it should, until finally, one of the blips began to move again, but the other had completely disappeared from the radar screen. Stewart and his team scrambled to get a hold on the situation. They hurriedly radioed the cockpit, but again they had trouble reaching the pilot. For whatever reason, it looked as though First Lieutenant Moncler had been forced to shoot the unidentified object out of the sky. They radioed the cockpit again, but still there was no answer. Then they noticed something. It wasn't the unidentified object that had vanished. It was the Scorpion. Stewart watched on with amusement as the unidentified object continued along its original east-west flight path as though nothing had happened. And then, after a few more seconds, that blip disappeared from the screen too. It had to be some kind of malfunction, a fault either in the plane's mechanics or something on the ground. Stewart grabbed the nearest headset and made an urgent radio transmission to Avenger Red. Trying to keep his voice calm and steady, he ordered Moncler and Wilson to respond and confirm their location. But there was nothing but static. As he tried again and again, an uneasy silence settled over the ground control room. As the minutes ticked past, the knot of dread in his stomach began to tighten as the unthinkable truth sank in. A US Air Force fighter jet had just dropped off the face of the earth, possibly downed. After several frantic moments of unanswered calls to the cockpit, Second Lieutenant Stewart requested reinforcements. Although the base had a second fighter jet ready to be scrambled at short notice, it was currently out on a patrol flight. Stewart radioed its pilot, First Lieutenant William Mingenbach. Keeping his words as simple and dispassionate as he could, he tried to explain what had happened. Then he directed Mingenbach to fly towards Avenger Red's last known location. Stewart and his colleagues still held out hope that there could be a rational explanation for it all. Patchy radio reception wasn't unusual, and it was highly possible that the bad weather had simply damaged some element of the aircraft, leading to a total loss of radar and radio contact with the ground. If another aircraft could get physically close enough to the lost jet, they might be able to get through to it. After 30 minutes of flying, Lieutenant Mingenbach's jet approached the last known location of Avenger Red. A crackling sound squawked out at the radio. Through the chaos of white noise, he heard a short transmission. The words were impossible to make out. It was like snatches of a conversation, somebody forever in the middle of a sentence. But the voice was unmistakable to Mingenbach and his navigator. It was Felix Moncler Jr. Then a few seconds later, the transmission cut out. Utterly convinced of what they'd heard, Mingenbach frantically tried to re-establish contact with Avenger Red, but after five more failed attempts, they gave up. A disappointed Lieutenant Mingenbach contacted ground control to give them the update. They agreed to move to Plan B, conducting a visual search of the area to look for any signs of the lost aircraft. This was easier said than done, given the weather conditions. Aside from the scattered snowstorms, the cloud was unusually thick and low in the sky, meaning the only way to conduct a visual search was to fly at a low altitude, which in turn put the jet at high risk of icing up. So a third plane was sent up to assist, one that was better equipped to fly in low icy conditions. For close to an hour, the two jets circled the area, searching for any visual signs of Avenger Red, while making periodic attempts to reach the aircraft via radio. But by 8:30 p.m., the whole thing was beginning to feel like a doomed mission. Even based on the most conservative calculations, Moncler's jet would be out of fuel by now. And as the snow grew heavier and the conditions more treacherous, the search crews were stood down. For the rest of the night, US Air Force staff and their Canadian counterparts worked tirelessly to locate the missing plane. Crews on the ground searched for debris, while numerous aircraft continued to patrol from above as much as weather permitted. But by the morning, they'd found nothing. There was no debris, no signs of a crash, and no trace of either the plane or its two occupants. Air Force officers are trained to be ready for anything, but nobody was prepared for this scenario. There was no protocol for a disappearing plane, and certainly no rule book on how to explain it to the public. The search continued for the best part of a week, but was called off on November 28th. Then, 2 days later, a glimmer of hope was offered by a group of railway workers stationed about 100 miles north of the Kinross Air Force Base. They claimed to have heard what sounded like a strange, loud crash on land on the night in question. The search resumed for a short time, only for rescuers to come up empty-handed once more. An initial report was filed on the night of November 23rd, offering a brief and bare-bones version of events. That report was summarized in an official news release, which stated that the missing jet was followed by radar until it merged with an object and then vanished. The Chicago Tribune published a front-page story under the headline, "Jet, Two Aboard, Vanishes Over Lake Superior." Within hours, the story was making news nationwide. It's possible that the US Air Force had simply underestimated the growing fascination with UFOs. Either way, seemingly stunned by the fevered attention surrounding the disappearance of one of their planes, they quickly tried to backtrack. They retracted their initial news statement and instead released a new one, offering a more complete and pointedly more rational version of events. First Lieutenant Felix Moncler Jr. and Second Lieutenant Robert Wilson had been assigned to intercept an unidentified aircraft. The mission had been a success, and the aircraft had been intercepted and identified as a Royal Canadian Air Force plane. Radar contact had been lost shortly after the jet turned round to head back to base, and soon after that, the plane had presumably crashed into Lake Superior. As to why a capable pilot would have lost control of his aircraft, the statement suggested that Moncler had likely been overcome by sudden vertigo, a rare but dangerous condition where a pilot becomes spatially disorientated, potentially resulting in fatal mistakes. The plane disappearing from radar was blamed on unusual atmospheric conditions in the area, and the lack of wreckage was no surprise. Lake Superior is the second largest lake in the world in terms of surface area, with an average depth of 1,300 feet. An object that landed inside it could quite easily disappear and remain unfound to this day. On the face of it, it all seemed plausible enough. But the holes in the narrative were obvious to anyone who was paying attention. And it didn't help that the authorities couldn't seem to agree with each other about what had happened. For a start, Canadian officials, publicly refuted the US Air Force's account. According to them, all of their aircraft were accounted for, and there had been no flights in the area in question on the night of November 23rd. One Canadian Air Force plane had been flying near the border, but they denied that it had ever crossed over into US airspace. Whatever the unidentified object had been, it did not come from Canada, at least according to the Canadians. Which left the tricky, unanswered question, where had it come from? It didn't take long for conspiracy theories to take hold. During the 1950s, roughly a quarter of the American population believed in what's known as the extraterrestrial hypothesis, the idea that many unidentified flying objects are in fact alien spacecraft from other planets. So once word got out that two US Air Force pilots and their jet had vanished mysteriously without a trace at the very moment they'd crossed paths with a UFO, many people jumped to what they saw as the obvious conclusion. It was an alien abduction. At the time, there were a number of civilian groups conducting research into UFOs. The largest and most well-resourced was the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, or NICAP. In the years following the incident at Kinross Air Force Base, they repeatedly tried to obtain more information about what exactly had happened. Then one day, some investigators from NICAP made the unsettling discovery that the event was completely missing from official Air Force records. There was no mention at all of an intercept mission from the night of November 23rd, 1953. Despite their best efforts to uncover the truth, the case went cold for more than a decade. It was in late October 1968 when two prospectors were digging about near an area known as Cousins Cove, roughly 70 miles north of Kinross, along the coast of Lake Superior. Wandering around the bush near the shoreline, the pair spotted some unusual metallic debris. On closer inspection, it was quite clearly the remnants of an aircraft. After a careful inspection from the Ontario Provincial Police, the type of metal was found to be far heavier than would be used in a commercial aircraft, suggesting it was very likely to have been a military plane. Although this discovery reignited interest in the case among UFO believers, it didn't garner much wider attention. Reports on the discovery itself are sketchy, and there is no record of whether the debris was ever proven to be from an F-89, never mind the one that went missing from Kinross 15 years before. And so, once again, the strange case of First Lieutenant Felix Moncler's missing Scorpion jet went quiet once again. That was until 2006, when UFO researcher Francis Ridge received a strange email. It was late August in 2006 that Francis Ridge was contacted by a man named Preston Miller. The email included an excerpt from an Associated Press story suggesting that the missing F-89 had been discovered by an underwater search team while taking scans of the bottom of Lake Superior. There was a link too. When Ridge clicked it, it opened up a website for the Great Lakes Dive Company. It contained two startling images taken with side-scan sonar. Both showed images of what looked to be a completely intact aircraft with the telltale tip tank and upswept tail reminiscent of the F-89 Scorpion. Francis Ridge immediately posted the email on the website UFO Updates, and before long, the apparent discovery was flooding UFO forums and message boards all over the world. When a number of reporters attempted to contact the Great Lakes Dive Company, they were directed to a man called Adam Jimenez, who declared himself the group's spokesperson. Jimenez confirmed the images were real with a number of outlets and even appeared on famed late-night talk show Coast to Coast, talking to much-revered UFO researcher Linda Moulton Howe. What Jimenez then revealed was that something else had also been found at the bottom of the lake, close to the F-89. A strange metallic teardrop-shaped object of unidentifiable origin. Jimenez suggested this could well be the object that downed Felix Monkler's plane. A short time later, apparent sonar images of this object were also posted on the Great Lakes Dive Company website. As the UFO community became increasingly excited by the news, efforts were made to verify the Great Lakes Dive Company's credentials. However, no further evidence beyond the website could be found for their existence. The so-called Adam Jimenez proved equally difficult to pin down, with only the email address and a phone number provided on the website proving that he existed too. 3 weeks after Francis Ridge received his mysterious email, the Great Lakes Dive Company website was taken offline, and the mysterious Adam Jimenez stopped replying to inquiries. It was, sadly, just a hoax. To this day, no trace of Felix Monkler or Robert Wilson has ever been found. No convincing explanation has ever emerged to fill in all of the bizarre gaps in the official narrative. No official version of events seems to account for the aircraft vanishing at the precise moment it intersected with the UFO, nor do they explain the mysterious 5-second snatch of Felix's voice, supposedly heard more than an hour after the supposed crash by the crew of the second Scorpion sent to find them. To quote Donald Kehoe, a Marine Corps aviator turned UFO researcher, the Kinross incident, as it became known, remains one of the strangest cases on record anywhere in the world. This episode was written by Emma Dibden and produced by Richard McLean Smith. Thank you as ever for listening. Unexplained is an AV Club Productions podcast created by Richard McLean Smith. All other elements of the podcast, including the music, are also produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Unexplained, the book and audiobook, is now available to buy worldwide. You can purchase from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Waterstones and other bookstores. Please subscribe to and rate the show wherever you get your podcasts, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation or a story of your own you'd like to share. You can find out more at unexplainedpodcast.com and reach us online through X and Blue Sky at unexplainedpod and Facebook at facebook.com/unexplainedpodcast.